Welcome to the Senate Committee on Education and General Government. Remember the rules in this committee. No cell phones or anything that makes noise will go off. Otherwise, you write a check to the Common School Fund. We haven't had one of those in a while, so I don't know if you want to test fate, but I have really good ears. We also have a sign-up sheet on the left over there. Let me tell you the order we're taking these in today. We're doing HJM 3 first, then followed by HB 2243, and then 3436, and then we'll do the work sessions. Okay, so with that, I will open a public hearing on HJM 3A. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, HJM 3A requests that the U.S. Secretary of Education and the U.S. Department of Education work with Oregon and the Department of Education when determining adequate yearly progress for the 2006-2007 academic year if Oregon assessment scores or participation rates suggest that there was a disruption caused by the discontinuation of service by the state's assessment contractor.
Great. Thank you. We are graced with the presence of the Honorable Representative Betty Kampf and Mr. Ed Dennis.
Good morning, Chair Walker, committee members. It's an honor to be here. For the record, my name is Betty Kampf, and I represent House District 22. And your staff, Ms. Richardson, basically said everything that I was going to say. And so
she's so good.
She is, but what I would just highlight a couple of different pieces. I worked with the department to write HJM 3 to really to ensure that our students and our teachers and our schools were not penalized for, I call it a snafu in the process. For many years now, not depends how old you are, probably at least 5 to 7 years, almost all students, and particularly our young third graders and fifth graders, they've always taken the state assessment test on the computer. They're very computer literate. They know how to use those mice, and they take the test and click and do the next question. Because of the dramatic change of shifting, having to shift because there is an ongoing legal situation with the technology provider of the TESA system for Oregon, and so our students then had to take their final tests with paper and pencil. And with that change and that variable, there's a strong possibility there will be a significant change and predictably a dip in student scores. And so this bill is to ensure that there's a wide open dialogue with Secretary Spelling, Margaret Spelling, and she understands that if schools do have this change, and my perspective is this probably will impact schools that are right in the middle, high-performing schools, they'll still be fine with making adequate yearly progress. But those schools that are right on the cusp of going one way or the other, and there's a number of them, would we be the ones we'd want to look the closest at. And adequate yearly progress, just a little, and Ed Dennis can answer these questions better, but as a previous principal in a middle school that had not met adequate yearly progress, because one year we do really well and the next year we'd have student scores that would dip again, it takes 4 years in succession in order to completely meet adequate yearly progress. And so if you dip one of those 4 years, you start the cycle all over again, and then it'll take you another 4 years of performance to get out of the cycle from not meeting. It is a very rigorous, strenuous cycle that you can be in for quite some time, and sometimes it's one student score that can put you into that cycle. And so I ask your support on this so that we as a Oregon legislature send the message that we want this conversation to happen, particularly for those schools that are right there on the edge, and that those scores aren't used this year, that we are just, they're exempted. So with that, I ask your support, and if you have any questions, I brought Ed Dennis to help answer them.
Okay. Well, thank you, Representative Combe. I think I'd like to hear from Mr. Dennis about the status of the lawsuit and where we are.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Ed Dennis from the Department of Education. The lawsuit status, we're moving forward. We've put our complaints forward. Primarily, our objective has been to protect our proprietary information. I think a couple of you who are on Ways and Means have heard this. And they have in their possession, our vendor, about $9 million worth of our test items. In value, and so we want to make sure that those don't get used anywhere else in the country. They don't show up someplace else, and so we have an injunction. We've secured an injunction to that effect. As far as damages go, and the things that go a little bit further in the lawsuit, we're pursuing that. The judge has encouraged us to jump into the discovery process, and so we've done that. In fact, Doug Costi, our assessment director, is on his way back from New York City and I think Philadelphia. We did a couple depositions with DOJ officials here recently. But let me be real clear that for me, and they've countersued along the same lines.
I was going to ask you that.
They've countersued and said that, you know, all of the things that we've talked about, you know, breaching the contract and good faith and dealings and also some defamation claims. Our lawyers feel confident that we're in a good position, but, you know, who knows on all those kinds of things. My primary interest in and why I'm primarily happy about the discovery process being accelerated is getting back to our eyes on the prize. And our eyes on the prize for us are not wanting schools to get mislabeled for something that they didn't do. A vendor pulled the plug in the middle of the year, and a state had to shift to paper and pencil. And so while we think the scores are actually going to be comparable, we actually have a study that's been done already, we are concerned about the disruption, about the conflict that creates. And so the superintendent has already had two conversations with Margaret Spellings, everybody in our congressional delegation, Senate leadership today in D.C., which is why she can't be here. And the message that we're putting forward is that this is not a vendor dispute with a state. This is a very clear problem that has happened. We couldn't control it. And so the reason why I'm happy about the discovery process is we're talking to people out there, other entities that have maybe gone through something similar to what Oregon had gone through, maybe had a similar sort of string of events happen. And that's going to help us make our case. Because really what this resolution gets at, what this memorial gets at, and what our efforts are going towards is that the U.S. Department of Education will grant us some flexibility and work with us if indeed the paper and pencil scores come back statistically significantly different than they should be. So what we'll do is we'll say to them, give us an opportunity to work with you to create a statistical adjustment so that we can correct this problem and schools don't get punished under the federal system that shouldn't be punished.
Okay.
That's our goal.
All right. Any questions? Senator Cruz?
No, I don't like the federal system, period, but that's a whole other issue, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
We play by the cards or...
I understand that, Chair.
Senator Walker? Yes, I'd just like to make one comment as somebody that's worked in schools up to just 2 years ago. The disruption that is caused by this shutdown is phenomenal. The teachers with many schools, and our school district has been fortunate in acquiring a number of technology grants. Our system is really at one of the top levels of providing this opportunity for students. And yet you still organize your teaching schedule, because everybody has to rotate around the computers. And the disruption when you can't test on the day you're supposed to test, it is just... it throws everything out of whack. And so when that couple of weeks were happening, when the system was up and down, it's not giving your teachers an opportunity to help their children be successful. It's just the students get frustrated in less than 5 seconds. The teacher's frustration level takes about 7 seconds. So it is a challenge, and I really commend what the department has been doing to do the best they can, because I can't imagine how many nasty, ugly phone calls they got. And I'm sure it was plenty.
All right, thank you. I don't see any other questions, so I appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on HJM 3, open work session.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 3 to the Senate floor with a recommendation that it be adopted.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 3A to the floor of the Senate with a recommendation it be adopted. Any discussion? Okay. Ms. Gravel?
Senator Lester?
Aye.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Excused.
Vice
Chair Cruz? Aye. Chair Walker? Aye. HJM 3A is on its way. Who would like to carry that? Someone have a burning desire?
I'll do it.
Okay. There you go. I would have said if you hadn't. Okay. Terrific. We will close the work session on HJM 3A and open a work session on that would be a public hearing on HB 2243A. Ms. Richardson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is an updated staff measure summary in your kind of pile of materials that's toward the bottom, although it's not entirely updated because there are two sets of amendments that you also have before you that are not written up there, but I'll give you what we've got and we can talk about what else we might have for discussion. House Bill 2243A removes the discretion of applicants for renewal of license to choose between normal license terms and extended terms offered by the agencies. It modifies the expiration date for certain licenses, permits, and certificates to allow agencies to establish different expiration dates by rule. It provides for payment for licenses directly to agency under certain circumstances. It allows agencies to amend administrative rules without hearing or prior notice to change the name of an office, program, or division, or to correct an address or telephone number. It changes the authorization for creating a combined license processing pilot project within the Department of Consumer and Business Services to the combined license processing programs and deletes the sunset on combined licensure program provisions. It removes the requirement that the Director of Aviation Department have airport operations and management experience. The dash A-10s, which are written up there in your staff measure summary and are before you, shift the administration of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots from the Department of Transportation to the Public Utility Commission. It lists the commission's administrative duties and oversight of the board and establishes a pilot account separate and distinct from the general fund. The A-11s that you have before you are conflict amendments that have an effective date for the transfer of the Board of Maritime Pilots between those two agencies. The A-12s that you have before you are conflict amendments, and they, in looking at the idea of transferring the Board of Maritime Pilots between the agencies, LFO felt like there wasn't enough language to kind of successfully complete the transfer from the Department of Transportation to the Public Utilities Commissions. So the A-12 has language that I understand meets what LFO was looking for to really transfer those duties. So that's what we've got.
Well, great. Thank you. And I'm going to let the committee know and those in the audience know, and it might make you all get a little squirrely, but I like this relating clause. So we're not moving this bill today. We're going to hold on to it because there might be some things that go into this bill. So I'm just letting you know that. But I will hear from you all today about your numerous amendments. And then this bill will come back at a later date. So let's hear from Patrick Allen. And I don't know if that sends shivers up people's spines, but I've actually got something in mind already. We'll just keep them guessing, Senator Cruz,
yes,
won't we?
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Patrick Allen, I manage the state's Office of Regulatory Streamlining. I'm part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll just say the last time I was involved in a bill that related to agencies, I think the dash C-16 version is what finally passed both chambers. So,
you knew it was coming, though, Mr. Allen, didn't you?
It takes a lot to shake me on this bill. I'm going to try to give you a rundown of sort of the six main things that this bill and the amendments you have in front of you do. If we get down to discussions about the last couple of things related to aviation or Board of Maritime Pilots, there are folks here in the audience who can probably go into more detail if you desire it, but I'm going to try to give you the whole scope of what all is here and why.
Okay, great.
And what I've had passed out is sort of a handy table of contents to the bill. It gives you a little bit of a rundown of what's in the various sections, if that helps at all. What the bill comes out of the Governor's Regulatory Streamlining Initiative, and most of what's here really has to do with the basic idea of how to make business regulations cheaper, faster, simpler, easier to understand without lowering standards. The first part of the bill, Section 1, deals with license terms. You may recall last session you passed a bill that gave agencies the discretion, if it was consistent with public health and safety, to look at statutory license terms and consider offering to licensees longer terms. So if I'm operating an electrical contracting business that has a statutory term of 1 year, you gave the agency the authority to offer them an extended term up to 5 years if that was a prudent thing to do. And in that bill, as part of the discussion, was the notion of, well, gee, 5 years, that's going to be five times the fee. We ought to give the licensee the choice. Do they want that longer term or do they want a shorter term? During the interim in practice, as we looked at how do we make that work, we came to the realization that that created multiple classes of licenses with multiple terms, and then what happens if partway through they decide they want to do something different, and it just sort of crashed of its own weight in terms of the complexity of offering that choice of a license term. And so what this does is it preserves the notion of being able to offer longer term licenses to cut down on paperwork and the amount of stuff a licensee has to do through the renewal process, but takes away that notion of they get to choose, do they want a short-term license or a long-term license, that would be done through an administrative rule process, so all the stakeholders would be at the table and be able to weigh in on that issue. The bulk of the bill then, sections 2 through 57, in detail deal with another issue that you took up in a number of committees last session, where there's a statutory license expiration date. State law will say this license expires on December 31st every year or whatever the case might be. There were about four bills last session, as I recall, that gave agencies the ability either to explicitly use most commonly birth month as a renewal date or gave them authority to simply set the date in rule. Sections 2 through 57 of the bill basically, based on your feedback last session, to say, gee, this is a good thing, let's do more of it. We went and looked and tried to find every single place in statute where there's a license expiration date in statute. And what we did is we left the language be that it could be that date in statute or such other date as the agency may adopt by rule. So if they like it the way it is, they don't have to do anything. It stays the way it is. If they want to change it, they have to go through a public rulemaking process and engage with their stakeholders, and then they can pick some other date. The benefit of that, of course, is that you can spread the work out over the course of a year. It lets you smooth the workflow out, and from my perspective, most importantly, it lets you do a better job troubleshooting license renewals. Things always come up at the last minute when someone realizes there's a problem with what they've got. If all of the licenses are there on the same day waiting to be renewed, the ability of the agency to troubleshoot that and help a licensee goes way down. If it's spread out, they can do a better job with
it. So let me make sure I understand. Then all licenses now are going to be renewed on birth date?
No. As with the passage of this bill, nothing automatically happens. All licenses stay what their statutory dates are, but it gives the agency the ability to make a policy choice. Does it want to change it to some other system? Birth month is the most common, but it wouldn't be the only way to do it, and they'd have to go through a rulemaking process to do that.
Okay. So it gives flexibility to the agency.
Correct.
Okay.
Or it could be, they could go to when you apply, that becomes your date,
anniversary date, sure,
right,
yeah.
Right, right.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a bill on the floor yesterday in the Senate that nearly a majority determined to be ill-advised with respect to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the way that they would assess their fees in their licensing process. And they determined in that bill, and it passed by one vote, that those fees would be, even if it was for 1 month during the licensing period or for the regular full period, the fees would be charged in full. My question is there anything in this bill that opens that door for other agencies to do the same?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, the bill is silent to the fee issue. In the experience with agencies that did this individually previously, they usually ended up with some kind of a fiscal plan for how to convert from whatever kind of a date they were on to whatever sort of a date system they were moving to. Board of Chiropractic Examiners comes immediately to mind, where a part of their budgeting process was during X biennium, we're going to make this switch, and so here's how that's going to look, and there was a fairly full discussion about that. But the bill itself is silent to the issue.
I guess my question, Madam Chair, would be, would the agencies be required to come back with statutory changes, as did OLCC, if this bill passes?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, the bill is silent to that issue. The would seem that the question would be, what's the actual budget impact to the agency, and would there be a requirement in the budgeting process as they deal with fees, and that would be the place where a discussion about what's the fiscal plan for moving from one date to another would occur.
Senator Morse, might I suggest that you have a further conversation about that, and if you're uncomfortable, you'll have time to work up another amendment. Because I agree with you. I think they should have to come back if they want to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, based on what we did last session with those few agencies we did this to, I'm not sure it opens that door, but to make sure it doesn't, I think it might be appropriate. But I think this just allows them the flexibility to change dates, and it doesn't allow them to do what was proposed in the OLCC bill yesterday. But
yeah, I think that's right. I think the only place where there's something anything like that is in the act. What happens in the actual year you make the changeover for people whose date changes during the course of the year, and after that, I think it really is, as you say, a different issue. But I'd be happy to follow up and figure out if there's a way we can clarify that.
I think we can just make sure instead of guessing.
Sure.
And since we have a little time.
Absolutely.
We're happy to do that. So sections 2 through 57 are taken care of.
257. Let me hit quickly the other pieces of the bill. I saw a couple of furrowed brows when your administrator was reading the portion dealing with expedited rulemaking. Right now in state statute, there is the capability to do rulemaking that does not involve the public notice and hearing requirements in a standard rulemaking for very, very non-controversial technical changes. And what this does is add to the list of things that can be done that way, changing the name of a program, changing or correcting the address of a local office, changing phone numbers. Right now, those are required to go through a full-blown public notice and comment rulemaking. This requires that whatever that change is, not have a substantive impact on the underlying program. But for certain agencies, and Department of Human Services comes immediately to mind, a huge amount of things like that that are in rule for the agency that they'd like to be able to do a more straightforward, simple corrections kinds of activity, and this would add to the flexibility to do that. That's in Section 58 of the bill.
And, Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Is there in there also, I'm assuming it probably currently is, but there needs to be a process for if somebody says, wait a minute, this isn't a simple technical change, this needs to go to a full-blown process.
You can challenge the rulemaking,
right.
But it would be an after-the-fact challenge.
Okay. Madam Chair, I understand, these technical changes, to go through full-blown rulemaking process to change your phone number makes no sense whatsoever. But I guess my concern is that we're leaving too much I don't want to leave too much discretion to the agency to say this is just a technical change when indeed it may have some substantive impact.
Well, Chair Walker, Vice Chair Cruz, two things about that. First, the list in the bill is specific. It's not a discretionary list. It specifically enumerates the things that can be changed that way, and then adds on top of that the notion that those changes cannot result in a substantive program change. So our hope is that we've constructed it consistent with what you're...
That list.
articulated. It's in Section 58 of the bill.
I haven't read the full bill yet.
It's only 36 pages or 41 pages long.
Not very plain language, I'm afraid.
That's going to change next session.
Sections 59, 60, and 61 of the bill were an addition that was made during session, but that also deal with regulatory streamlining. The Restaurant Association came forward on the House side and proposed the notion of creating an online system where a restaurant owner with locations in multiple counties could go to one web portal and renew licenses in multiple counties in one place. There's a roughly analogous system available now through the State Building Codes Division where someone doing a project can plug in an address and deal with building permits in multiple jurisdictions based on who issues which kind of permit where. What 59, 60, and 61 do is basically let us proceed with trying to explore what kind of a system we would need to create to do that. Last session, you passed legislation that authorized combined licensing pilot projects in our office. This would, and it had a sunset. This would remove the sunset and basically make that a capability that we could use going forward. And it would specifically look at the restaurant issue. The reality in there's some question about whether the restaurant portion of this really needs statute to be done. The practical reality for restaurant licensing is there's a statutory system where the various interests in the restaurant industry, local county health folks, State Department of Human Services, restaurant industry, work on what's the plan for how licensing happens, how fees are collected and distributed, and those kinds of things. And anything that happens would need to run through that process. But this makes clear that there's the authority to explore that. The reality is, in the next interim, the best we expect to be able to do, and the Restaurant Association understands this, is to go figure out what do we need to do to come up with some, with a portal like this, and we would need to come back to the next session to make a portal like that actually happen. Then the last two pieces to talk about, Section 62 deals with the Aviation Department. Currently in statute, the Director of the Department of Aviation is required to have experience managing airports or with airport operations experience. This is a proposal from Senator Johnson to remove that requirement.
On cue.
Ah. She just walked in, so we'll have, since you know little about aviation, Mr. Allen, we'll turn this one over to Senator Johnson, who used to direct that agency, did you not?
I did, Madam Chair.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Betsy Johnson. I am a senator from District 16. And not only did I run the department once upon a time, but I helped in the creation of the statutes that guide the department. The Department of Aviation was once a section within ODOT, and it became a freestanding agency.
Yeah, when I remember that. We did that in 1999.
Yep.
That's right.
Against the governor's wishes.
Senate Bill 108.
It was not the current governor. It was another governor.
But we made a little tiny problem in the bill, and that was that we made it a requirement that the head of the agency be a pilot. And the problem was that you put a pilot in a suit, and instead of having a good manager, we had a well-dressed pilot. So we are coming to you now based on the experience of the agency being in very severe financial difficulties and being turned around by someone who does not have very good experience. I have seen the error of my ways, and I'm here as an advocate for this bill, Section 62, that would not have the requirement that the manager be.
We love humor in this committee. Well, I appreciate that, Senator Johnson. You are a pilot yourself. A well-dressed one and a very smart one. So you actually defy the convention that you just shared with us. But
well, Madam Chair, thank you. I think this is a good change. I think what this recognizes is that while the governor has the appointing authority over this agency, and we would appreciate, we speaking as a member of the aviation community, would appreciate a portal through which our advice could come with respect to the nomination of a head of the department, we no longer need to have rigid pilot or aeronautical experience enshrined in statute. We would just be looking for the best manager who would understand state budgeting and could keep the agency fiscally sound. So that's my piece on this. As long as I'm here, can I pitch for one other the Dash-12s.
Oh, okay.
The Dash-12s come to you as a result of some negotiations that have happened all this session. They would transfer the location of the Board of Maritime Pilots from ODOT to the PUC. I became aware of this issue handling ODOT's budget for the last four sessions. It seems that the PUC is, and this is all agreed upon, the PUC is a willing recipient, ODOT is a willing giver-upper. The people regulated by the Board of Maritime Pilots are in agreement. I think some of them are here in the room. The fact is that the Board of Maritime Pilots just is not a great fit in ODOT. And given that the PUC has experience in contested case, laying down a record, they have the equipment, they have the facilities to be able to deal with some of the issues that come before the Board of Maritime Pilots, in a completely satisfactory negotiation, this bill brings to you the opportunity to move the Board of Maritime Pilots from ODOT to the PUC. And I think there are others that can comment on that.
Well, ODOT is here in the room. I was already told they're on board with it. And
I believe, Madam Chair, the PUC is here in the room, and I believe there are representatives of some of the pilotage grounds here. And it is my understanding, as I appear before you this morning in support of the Dash-12s, that this is all worked out and there should be no opposition.
Okay. Senator, you weren't in the room when I mentioned that I was holding this bill back for its relating clause.
I was informed out in the hall, Madam Chair, the mother of all relating clauses. I can understand that the bill might not move today.
And it's gold.
But I come in advocacy of those two small elements of a 311-page long bill or however long.
It's 41 pages at this point.
Here, can we throw crab pot limits in here, or do you want to do that another?
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll leave that up to the discretion of the Chair and the Vice Chair.
All right, thank you. Any questions of our panel? Okay, thank you both. Thank you for that detailed explanation, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Senator Johnson. I don't think we have a problem. I have no one else signed up to testify. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify? This is your last opportunity. Okay, well, terrific. As I indicated, we will hold this bill. You will all wait with bated breath to see what I add to it.
So, Madam Chair, I'm assuming at this point the relevant amendment is the 12, and the 10s and 11s are go where most amendments go.
Well, the 11 is a conflict amendment also.
Well, so it's the 12.
But the 12 contains
it both.
Thank
yes.
you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are you open to amendments that eliminate agencies?
No.
Ooh.
That I would not attender.
Which one are you interested in? I'd be curious.
Well, it's relating to agencies.
Yeah, I just wanted to see how they pick their ones in mind. See if anybody jumps in the back of the room.
Well, I don't know, Senator Morris. Let's have a conversation and keep people guessing.
Why do we need a pasteurizer operator?
I thought who's
selling or distributing eggs?
Sweat.
I have a list. I mean,
I'll let you all sort of play with it as well. Senator Metzger and I have something in mind. Okay, well, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2243A, and we're moving right along. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3436A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3436A permits the city to propose a revised 20-year population forecast if it is within 10 years before the city initiates evaluation or amendment of the city's urban growth boundary and the population forecast adopted by the county governing body no longer provides the 20-year population forecast. It permits the city to propose a 20-year population forecast if the current forecast was adopted more than 10 years before the city initiates evaluation or amendment of the city's urban growth boundary. The bill would authorize cities to adopt proposed forecasts if the county takes no action within 6 months after receiving a written request, if the city provides notice to other local governments in the county and includes the adopted forecast in a comprehensive plan or a document included in the plan by reference. It specifies that a properly adopted extended forecast satisfies statewide land use planning goals on urbanization to establish a coordinated 20-year population forecast for an urban area. It specifies that the process for establishing the population forecast is in addition to and not in lieu of the process established in goal and rule by the Land Conservation and Development Commission.
Okay. Well, some people are wondering why a land use bill is in this committee. It's a little bit more than just land use, and this committee is well-versed in that. So I would say get over it. The bill is here, and we're going to hear from it today. Let's see. We've got a couple of people who support this. Linda Ludwig, you have a guest. You want to come up? And then John Chandler, are you in the room too? Okay, we'll do a panel of three.
Madam Chair, I request to be in on this committee specifically so I wouldn't have to deal with John Chandler, and now you're bringing him up.
Well, I think you'll get your dose of humor this morning.
Right, make it a scene.
Okay. Ms. Ludwig, I think you probably should go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. House Bill 3436 deals with coordinated population forecasts, and it passed unanimously out of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee and unanimously off the House floor. Let me give you some background real quick on what coordinated population forecasts are. They are the foundation for meeting the state's planning requirements. All of our land supply analysis, transportation system plan, urban growth boundary amendments and adjustments, school capacity planning, even our water conservation management plans all start with the city's 20-year population forecast. Senate Bill 100, when it was passed in 1973, gave counties the authority in statute 195036 to coordinate the population forecast in the rural and urban portions of the county. So state statute requires counties to maintain this forecast, but it doesn't provide a remedy if the forecasts are never completed or not kept timely.
So they don't have to do anything because there's nobody to slap their hand, correct?
There is no remedy if it is not done in statute. That's correct,
okay.
Madam Chair. So last fall, LCDC initiated and completed Goal 14 rules, which deals with urbanization. And there was a work group formed and worked for some time. I was a member representing League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Brierley here with me was with the County Planning Directors Association. Also, Association of Oregon Counties, Thousand Friends, the Home Builders Association, the Association of Realtors. All the major players in the land use arena with the state agency representatives from several agencies, land use consultants, all worked together. And during this time, there was a survey done of the counties regarding the coordinated population forecast. And it was indicated that at that time, more than half of the 36 counties had either never done this, never completed this work, or hadn't kept these forecasts timely. They hadn't been completed within the last 10 years. So with that concern, and because of this historical void in completing this process and the importance of this process to cities, we advocated for rules that would allow cities to generate their own forecast if they hadn't been done, following the practice of what cities had done to date in order to fill that void. Rules were adopted, and the majority of this bill is, in fact, putting into statute the rules that were adopted. The bill does contain one other provision, and that's a time certainty for counties to respond when a city does generate a number. There is a six-month time period in the bill when a city generates the number and forwards it to the county for either approval, denial, or amendment of that city's number. So the essentially there's two ways the city can go about generating that number consistent with what's in the rule, and whether or not there was ever a number or it's older than 10 years or there is an update of the existing number that's less than 10 years old. Having these numbers is incredibly important to cities when we do our urban growth boundary expansions because the delays can cause impacts in the available land supply, which further lead to escalating land prices, particularly in our fast-growing regions. This often we've seen, especially in Central Oregon, most recently a ripple effect that causes speculation, further increasing land supplies. It becomes more difficult for cities when this happens to provide adequate services such as affordable housing in those new expansion areas because the land values get so very high. I want to be very clear, county inaction is not the only reason for delay in some of these population numbers, but it is one place right now we can provide a little more certainty that unreasonable delay does not occur. Given that cities are required to process development applications in 120 days, that's 4 months, counties have 5 months, 150 days, we thought it was very reasonable to give counties 6 months to be able to respond to a city-generated number. Cities that are growing quickly and receiving rapid population expansion have indicated that they need new numbers every 5 to 6 years. Otherwise, they suffer the lost opportunity costs of a shorter than 20-year land supply period. Let me give you a couple examples, and Mr. Brierley can talk about his city in Newburgh. Madras, which, as you well know, has been booming, hasn't had a coordinated forecast for over 10 years. And Redmond recently went through their process, and it took Redmond over a year to evaluate and have that coordinated number adopted by the county. Land prices during that time inside the UGB went from $100,000 an acre to $300,000 an acre.
Oh, wow.
Because they had 2 years of build-out left within the UGB. Land prices outside the UGB that were being brought into the boundary also received a considerable appreciation, although not quite that much. So being able to act quickly with speed and certainty is very important. Let me give you a couple of additional thoughts. I've heard two concerns regarding the bill, and I'd just like to put those on the record today here and be able to give you some background. Initially, we heard concerns voiced by the Association of Oregon Counties regarding the time certainty there. Since that time, we've softened the language from the original bill that was introduced to state that counties must take action within 6 months, or the city may adopt the forecast if it follows all the additional provisions, both in the rule and in the bill. I've also tried to offer the county association an incentives-based approach using some of the local government grant funds provided by DLCD every biennium to local jurisdictions to either hire Portland State University or an independent demographer to provide initial numbers so that we can keep this process rolling every 6 years. The resulting population projections would be a resource to cities and counties that they could use to update their comprehensive plans. This suggestion has been turned down to date as well as one where I suggested that in that process of the grants committee, if a county did apply for a different grant for another task, that they additionally be allocated a grant to, if they hadn't updated their population numbers, to be able to do that as well. That suggestion has not also been accepted, but what has happened, and I have been a member of the Grants Committee since its inception, as well as the Association of Oregon Counties, we've seen very few requests for counties to do this work for population allocation. This biennium, we had one county make a single request. We did agree, though, in the committee to prioritize the passage, to prioritize any grant requests that did come for this purpose, this forecasting purpose, but I believe without the passage of this bill, it won't make a whole lot of difference. This bill will provide a little bit of incentives for counties to come to the local government grants committee and request, I believe, a grant to do this work. The second concern we've heard was from Mr.
Can I stop you before you go there? Because my understanding is you serve on that grants committee through DLCD, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And you've seen very few grant requests in your time on the board or the committee. Counties know these grants are available, do they not?
Yes, they do, Madam Chair.
And I know there's another bill in this building that's causing a lot of angst in my community that Mr. Chandler just loves that allows Springfield and Eugene to go their separate ways on doing their available land supply study. And the city of Eugene was in my office saying, well, there are grants available, but who knows if we'll ever get one. So, I mean, that's the issue, too. The grants are available, but if you don't apply for them, then, of course, you're not going to get them. How much money is in that grant program, do you know?
The allocation for this year has been pretty consistent over the course of the last 10 years. There's $2.2 million for a two-year period for cities and counties for technical assistance issues as well as periodic review work tasks.
Okay, and if that money doesn't get used, does it just roll over and stay in the pot, or does it get used for something else?
I've been on the Grants, Madam Chair, committee since its inception, and we've always seen the funds exhausted. In fact, we were working this session to try to increase the amount of funds available.
Okay. All right. But the funds are there, and the counties need to make application, and if they don't, well, they don't get money. Nobody hands it out as a Christmas present, right? Just because you've been not naughty or but nice. Okay. Ms. Ludwig, what else did you have?
The second concern that I have heard in the last week is from Bob Rindy at DLCD regarding putting the recently adopted last year's rule language into statute. Mr. Rindy worked with me with legislative counsel to get the bill language correct that you see here today to his satisfaction. My feelings are, at this point, if we need to make subsequent adjustments to the statute later, if the rules change significantly, we can do that. There has been one city that has attempted to use this rule since it was adopted last year, the city of Harrisburg. And the city has disagreed with the interpretation, both by the county and DLCD, about how that rule was applied. And I believe it has caused some concerns within the department. However, when I asked if the rule would be adjusted or changed to deal with the city of Harrisburg's concerns, I have been told the answer is no. And Harrisburg does have another option in which they can take to help mitigate their concerns. Also, the very back of the bill, sub 4, we put in a clause that states that the process for establishing a population forecast provided in this section is in addition to and not in lieu of a process established by goal or rule of the Land Conservation Development Commission. I think this should help relieve some of those concerns as well.
So that leaves it open to DLCD to make changes to the rules as necessary, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. And again, we are in session, it seems, more and more often. If we need to make some conforming changes to statute, I have no problem with that.
Okay. Well, I'm not averse to putting goals in statute. We did it in this committee, actually, not too long ago. All right. Is that the end of your testimony?
Thank you. Barton Brierley is here with me. He's the planning director from the city of Newburgh. He's also the past president of the Oregon City Planning Directors Association, and he was also a member of the Goal 14 work group.
Okay. Mr. Brierley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Linda stated, I'm Barton Brierley, planning director for the city of Newburgh, and I am past president of the City Planning Directors Association and currently on the board. And I did serve on the Population Rules Committee, and I noted that I was one of the few people on that committee who actually had to go through the process of population coordination with the counties. I wanted to share with you some of our experiences in dealing with that, and because I don't think our experience is singular. I think this is something that many cities have either had to go through or will have to go through in the near future. We in Newburgh wanted to update our urban growth boundary and do some changes. Our urban growth boundary had been designed to accommodate population out to the year 2010, which isn't quite 20 years from now. And so we had to start the process, and the first thing you have to do is look at your population projections, because all the data, all the consultant money you spend, all the research you do, is based on that one number, the population projection. So it's very important to get that done early in the process. We went to the county and asked if they had coordinated population projections for all the cities in the county. They said that, yes, they did. They were a 2012 forecast, which still isn't a 20-year forecast at this point. So we asked the county about updating the the coordinated population projections. They were very willing to help and wanted to help, but they were overwhelmed by the process, overwhelmed by, you know, the idea of going to all the counties and kind of what process they'd have to go through to get updated coordination. So we hired a professional demographer from Portland State University to create a population projection for Newburgh. We got the numbers back. We took them to various community forums, and they were generally accepted in the community. We gave them to the county and said, here's the numbers we'd like to be coordinated. Again, they just weren't sure the process they'd have to go through to do coordination at that time. So we moved forward, we adopted the projections, we submitted them to the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Our population projections were acknowledged as complying with the statewide planning goals. We went through a year and a half long process to determine how we want to amend our urban growth boundary. We actually got a letter from the Department of Land Conservation and Development that supported what we were proposing. The county didn't have any objections to our urban growth boundary. We had a hearing, which you're adding a significant amount to your urban growth boundary. Surprise, we had no one speak in opposition to what we were proposing. So I wanted to point out that our proposal wasn't something kind of on the edge that, you know, maybe should be accepted or not, but was very much in line with how we think we should be doing planning. At the hearing, the county had no opposition to the proposal, except for they said, well, we still haven't coordinated your population projection. So we said, well, how can we do this? And they still weren't quite sure what process they were going to go through. This is after we'd been through working on this for over a year and a half. We offered, well, we'll do the coordination. We'll go to all the counties or all the cities and deal with that. And we ended up actually contacting all the cities and counties and getting information from them that they were acceptable with our coordination with our population projections. And ultimately, finally, before the final hearing on our urban growth boundary, the county did sent us a letter saying that they were satisfied that our population projections were coordinated. You can see the kind of consternation that caused us during that process. It happened to go well, but if at the end, you know, after a couple of years, they said, well, maybe we want something different, you see that the problems that would have caused. What this bill does is give a clear path, give a direction that you can go. You can go different directions, too, but if you want to just go a straight, clear path and know that at the end you will get a number that you can rely, that's what this the bill gives, and it's very essential to our community and to, I'm sure, a lot of other communities who will be wanting to update their comprehensive plans in the near future.
So, Mr. Brierley, if I understand from your detailed explanation, thank you. Your city had to go out and do its own population forecasting because the county wouldn't do it.
Yes.
So you had to do what the county is supposed to do under state law.
Yes.
Okay. Question from Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might just postulate a theoretical. If you had a community of 2,000 people and you had a new employer come into that city that represented 500 workers, and the city wanted to expand its urban growth boundary, and the population projection was only 8 years old, what would be the course of action?
You can go and modify your population projections based on something like that. You can develop a new projection and submit that to the county for coordination. This particular bill would not give you that same sort of clear path based on a significant change in a community like that. But if in kind of standard circumstances, this would provide you that sort of clear path.
Well, Madam Chair, my question was really focused at the 10-year number in the bill. We can't forecast revenue in this state more than a year. We do it for 2 years. You know, and these impacts that occur in communities when, you know, and we're out encouraging locations of business into the state, how are we responsive to those changes that don't fit within arbitrary rules that we establish, either by rule or by statute?
Chair Walker, Senator Morse, as I understand the bill, this bill does not preclude doing population projections other ways. It just provides one way that is acceptable.
Ms. Ludwig, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Morse. Barton is absolutely right, and that situation does exist. This bill is not the end-all with this population forecast situation. It does provide a mechanism for one situation. The 10-year issue was talked about quite a bit in work group, that time frame. And I'll be perfectly honest, there are members of us at this table who thought that a 10-year time period was probably too lengthy. But we also had at that same table that we were negotiating the rule with, members from Thousand Friends, from other stakeholder groups that had greater concerns. To that end, it is my resolve to try to find a mechanism, either statutorily based at some point, obviously not this session because this doesn't provide an enforcement remedy, but maybe through the incentive process, to be able to have a system where new numbers are generated at least on a 5 or 6 year basis, because cities that are growing quickly, wanting to respond to the market, need those numbers. I don't believe this is rocket science. I know there are some politics involved, especially for the counties, But there's certainly to be able to generate a number with some reasonable deviation on both sides shouldn't be that difficult. Thank you.
Okay, that answer your question?
Well, I think there's a problem here. Let's proceed.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
All right. Mr. Chandler?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Suck it up, Senator.
Thank you. We're going to be enlightened.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and for this purpose, not a moving target, apparently. I've listened to Ms. Ludwig's testimony before with regard to the impact of this land supply issue on the city of Redmond, where I used to own property and used to serve on the Redmond City Council, and it reminds me that I'm a reverse economic indicator, apparently, because I did not hang onto my property when the land prices went up to $300,000 an acre. Here, in support of House Bill 3436, from the development committee standpoint, this issue of population forecasting and projecting is absolutely essential to what we do. Most of it is pretend, in a sense. You know, as Senator Morris observed, we have a hard enough time projecting out the next quarter, much less the next year, and going out 10 years or 20 years like urban growth boundaries require under state law is an exercise in educated guesswork for the most part. We're fine with that. What we're under our land use system, though, we have a series of assumptions that are made. One assumption is that you have state processes, state law, state rules, state guidelines. You have counties with certain sets of responsibilities. You have cities with other sets of responsibilities. Within that system, all those pieces have to mesh, or you get grinding noises and it starts to break down. With regard to urban growth boundary and the expansions of urban growth boundaries, the driving number is neat. Most of the public fistfights occur about which property comes in or which property doesn't come in. But before you ever get to the discussion of which property is going to come into the boundary or not, you have to decide whether or not you have a need to move the boundary. And that need analysis under state law is driven by the population forecast. And population forecast is an exercise in educated guesswork, where you look at what's happened historically, what's happening in the community, the scenarios like Senator Morse painted of a new employer opening up, all the things that demographers do when they run numbers, and then you figure out over the next period of time, this city is going to expand by X number of people, X number of jobs, and will require Y number of acres of expansion. Where the breakdown has occurred is under state law, counties are charged with the responsibility of allocating within their county to all the cities and the unincorporated area the population. As you heard in previous testimony, that hasn't always happened. And it certainly, even those places where it has happened, it hasn't been kept up to date. Which means that if you're a developer in a community or you're a city leader, you're looking at a bad set of data or at least an old set of data, and you have a very difficult time then meeting that threshold question of do you have need or not, even if other factors such as land price run-ups or housing price run-ups might indicate that there is in fact a problem. From our standpoint, we love both our friends in the cities and our friends in the counties deeply and sincerely, and we don't much care who does the projecting. We just know it has to get done. It has to get done in a timely fashion. If the counties can, then this bill doesn't change the county obligation at all. It says that it assumes that they're going to continue doing it. It simply provides a couple of off-ramps in those situations where the county either can't or won't. And we believe, with all respect to the counties, that in those cases there needs to be an escape valve. There needs to be a way for the cities to say, we are going to do the projections subject to the same requirements of state law that the counties are subject to run the numbers, figure out what the need is, and move forward with the planning. As you all know from your own experience in your communities, urban growth boundary management is a controversial issue under the best of circumstances. The last thing we believe you need is to add a mathematical crisis to an already tendentious political situation. Under this bill, which we support, the counties can and should. If the counties can't or won't for financial, political, or other press of other business, the cities can. That's already in state rule. The main difference this bill provides, two things. One is a deadline. So if the counties can't, cities can, and if the cities do, then the counties have to respond within a period of time. I think that's perfectly reasonable, assuming the cities follow the same procedures. The second thing that this bill does is it clarifies that, in fact, the cities do have that legal authority. There are some questions raised. I was on the work group as well, that Ms. Ludwig mentioned. There are some questions raised about whether or not the cities have the legal authority under current law to do those kind of projections, given that the authority has already been granted to the counties under statute. This bill makes it clear that, yes, in fact, they do, and here's the rules under which they have to operate. We think, again, the counties, we hope the counties do it. We encourage counties to do it. We support them doing it. We occasionally help to fund them when they do it. In those situations where they can't, won't, for whatever reason, it's certainly not an attack on county jurisdiction, we believe the city should be allowed to go forward, and we think this bill provides that pathway. Because the implications of it, frankly, are boundary expansions and discussions locally that take the process further into the future, causing economic dislocations both in terms of land prices and in terms of economic opportunities lost because of a lack of land supply. We think it's a good bill. We commend it to you, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
I have a question about funding. The county is supposed to do this under the statute, and therefore they pay for it, or they come to the grant committee and get grants to do it. If the cities are doing this because the county won't, does that mean the city's paying for it? The county doesn't get stuck with the bill, do they?
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct, and I will say that the cities are happy to take on that fiscal responsibility.
And
they need to.
Okay, so I'm having trouble here understanding why the counties object on that basis, but let me ask the second question. What is the average cost? I mean, I suppose it varies by city, by size of city. Newburgh is much smaller than Eugene, for instance. So, Mr. Brierley, what was your experience?
I can tell you we hired a professor from Portland State University, so there's some kind of free graduate student help in there. Our bill was $2,500.
That's it?
It was the best $2,500 we've ever spent, and I just did the math. You know, if every city in the state could get that price, we could get it all done for everywhere, and still have a lot of money left to allocate for other projects. I think that's a very low price. I would, you know, probably quadruple that for most cases, but still, we're not talking a whole lot.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I might put in a plug for two things in addition, based on your question.
You also indicated that your organization sometimes...
Yes, Madam Chair, we have helped on occasion at the local level fund these sorts of studies, and while we're happy to do that, that obviously raises some interesting political issues on the local level.
I'm sure it
when
does.
You have the developers paying for studies, even if it's done by an independent third party, Portland State, Eco Northwest, or somebody, some other certified group of smart people.
I think that's the issue in Springfield.
That is one of that. Yes, ma'am. That is one of the issues in Springfield. Having said that, There are two places where this legislature could help yet this session. One is increasing the grant funding that's available through DLCD that Ms. Ludwig mentioned to local governments. We have a very complicated planning system of which the population forecasting is just one piece of the complicated system. We expect local governments to do the state's heavy lifting, and the state, if you'll pardon my saying so, oftentimes kind of short hops the local governments in terms of money. Having more money from the state to the locals would be a huge help because the money is well spent there, and frankly it is doing the state's work in terms of implementing the state planning program. The second thing I would plug for, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, we discovered that when we were working on Senate Bill 1036, the excise tax bill that cleared your chamber last week, a dearth of information with regard to construction data, what is being built, where, what it's worth, what it does. Portland State used to run those numbers every quarter, if not twice a year, might have been. They're no longer in that business due to budget cuts. The state really needs that data, not for any particular legislative proposal, but to simply know what's happening out in the local governments in terms of our state's economy. No one's tracking that. I was surprised to find that. We have a pretty fair notion of housing permits. We don't have much of a notion of commercial industrial activity, of what sort, what magnitude, where it's happening. It's done local by local, and it's probably fairly low on the list of things for the locals to do because they have other things to tend to. That this legislature could help in making sure that service is available through the state, whether it be through the Office of Economic Analysis or through Portland State or pick your entity. It doesn't make a lot of
University
difference.
Of Oregon.
I still have a daughter there, so yes, we could be in the middle, I suppose.
I don't know. It always comes to Portland State. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question to Mr. Chandler. And both, or all three of the panelists. If a city wishes to expand its urban growth boundary, and the population forecast is 9 years old, and it's deemed to be grossly underestimating the growth in population, does the city have the ability under current either rule or statute to implement a new population forecast that allows it then to expand its urban growth boundary?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, and as previously indicated, this bill doesn't really address that one way or the other. What this bill is talking about is those situations where the city wishes to update on its own for whatever set of reasons. It's not just urban growth boundary. That's probably the most obvious example, but it has to do with other forms of money allocation and other things, whether it be transportation dollars or something else. In the situation you're describing, Senator Morris, a city can, based on an activity that happens locally, it could be under your earlier hypothetical, a new plant opening up or something of the sort, can make a case for need separate and apart from this process in the bill. They still have to demonstrate some reason for it. Cities are not allowed under state law to just dream something up, but by the same token, they're not necessarily required to, if an old timber town wants to change its destiny and turn into something other than that, they can make a case for that. They don't have to stay where they were historically. They can use historical extrapolation and point to the future, but they can also look at economic development activities locally, other sorts of planning activities that are trying to change their future and make accommodations for that as well. So in the scenario you mentioned, it may or may not be a fist fight depending on local politics, but they certainly can come in and try to make the case that they need more land under that scenario.
I think that answers the question you had a little bit ago. Okay, any other questions? This panel's been very informative. Thank you, all three of you. I'll call up Art Schlack and Bob Rindy.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I would like to give you, if I could, a quick summary of what actually this bill does, and especially to update you on the history of this bill. First of all, the problems that you just heard from the last panel, they're not new. The LCDC heard about them in spades last summer and last fall at the conclusion of about a three-year, four-year process with a consensus work group working, I don't know how many, probably hundreds of hours, to, as a consensus group, come up with ways to streamline the urban growth boundary process. I think it was a very positive process, a very productive process, and by and large, we've received lots of compliments on that work. What this, most of the problems that you just heard about population forecast, all of them are not solved, but most of them were solved by LCDC rules. This bill doesn't solve those problems. It reflects those rules, but those rules solve those problems. Most of this bill is already administrative rule. It was new rules adopted by LCDC last fall. The only thing in this bill that is new and different than those rules is Section 3, which provides for in my mind, probably an unusual and probably in the future, a situation that will never happen. And that's where a city does everything in LCDC's rules, most of which, to get to that Section 3, the authors of this have put all the rules into this bill. To get to Section 3, a city would send a population forecast to a county, and the county would simply do nothing for 6 months.
There is no Section 3.
Sub 3.
Sub 3
of Section 1.
Section 1, Sub 3A.
Yes. So, in other words, Sections 1 and 2, they're already LCDC rules. And there are other rules as well to help solve the problems that Ms. Ludwig described to you. There was one provision that did not have consensus by the work group, and that was to allow cities to unilaterally adopt the forecast following the safe harbor rules that LCDC adopted in 1 and 2, and the county did absolutely nothing in 6 months. There was no evidence presented that had ever occurred, but it could occur. We can certainly see a circumstance where counties are unable to respond in that amount of time. In fact, many cities take longer than 6 months to just do their own forecast. That aside, that's all that you gain from this bill, is an ability for, if in the unlikely event that a county simply does nothing, if the county turns down the city's forecast, or if they accept it, or if they change it, within 6 months, nothing in this bill operates. But all the forecasting, streamlining, and everything else is there in LCDC rule. What this represents is some part of the work group could not achieve consensus, went to LCDC as part of the consensus package, asked for an additional thing that LCDC denied. It wouldn't let them do this. This is an end run around that process. LCDC wants that process to keep going. When it adopted significant rules last fall, they then instructed staff to keep going, to keep the work group together. Let's keep the consensus going. This group is chaired by former Representative Marilyn Dell Works. I think we're all working together very well. I don't think it's a good thing that if one part of that group has one proposal, and really a fairly minor proposal, and they aren't able to achieve consensus, and in addition aren't able to achieve LCDC approval, they then come to you to get that through, and then we have to put it all together next session and keep going and try to keep the group working on what I think are additional changes to these rules in a consensus manner, but now with some of the sort of the fallout from the fact that if some one group or another isn't happy, they're going to come and change the rules. Well, our concern is especially about putting these rules in statute. They're brand new. And subsections 1 and subsection 2 are untried, except in our experience, one time. City of Harrisburg and Linn County came and talked with Lane Shetterly, our director, last week. They pointed out that the language is unclear, has multiple interpretations. That's in subsection 1. They said it didn't work for them. They would like us to change it. Contrary to what you just heard, we didn't tell the cities or them that we won't change it. We said LCDC has instructed us next biennium to continue this process. That is when we're going to change these things. But if this is ensconced in statute, frozen in statute, 1 and 2, section 1 and 2, we can't adjust these rules. Since Lane Shetterly became director of LCDC, we have probably changed more than 50 rules. Many times in response to court decisions that do things nobody had envisioned, many times because we, despite our best efforts to write a rule that does a certain thing, we don't get the wording correct Well, something happens and people misinterpret it, and we have to go back and change this. For example, mineral and aggregate rules, economic development rules, the transportation planning rules, which I'm sure John Chandler can talk to you at length about. John Chandler has said to me many times how he regrets taking certain provisions and putting them in statutes. I think 197, 296 is a good example. We put these things in statute. It doesn't turn out the way we wanted them to, and it's very hard to change, and almost impossible. But these new rules, which we've already discovered don't quite work right, we won't be able to change them because subsections 1 and 2 are now in statute. We're going to have to come back to the legislature to do that.
Mr. Rendy, you're repeating yourself now, and I have to finish this committee.
Well, if I could just...
If you have something new, but now you're repeating yourself.
You know, if I could. I went to Linda Ludwig last week and offered an amendment. I think there's a way to mend this bill so that we don't put these in statutes. And you can have and leave Section 3 as it is so that the bill would do exactly what she's asked for it to do, but does not have 1 and 2 in it. And I submitted that with my written testimony.
Well,
I was told that she did not want to do that. I think it gives her exactly what she wants, but it allows us the freedom to amend these rules later that are in subsection 1 and 2.
You sent me an email last night and said it was attached, and it was not attached. So I don't know what your amendment is.
Well, I thought it was attached. I tried my best to attach it, but it is attached.
I have your testimony.
The page 2 of the testimony is the proposed amendment.
Okay. And what is that?
What that does is it's the bill, and you'll see that subsection 1 and 2 have been mostly eliminated or changed slightly so that subsection 3, which is really the guts of the bill, is left intact, but we don't put the actual rule wording that I predict we're now wanting to change in the statute. Instead, it references DLCD rules that have to do with population forecasts. And I think the advantage is that the subsection 3 part, the guts of this bill, would then apply in the future not just to these two rules that we want to change, but any additional ones that LCDC adopts in their next next
thank
round.
You. I would just like to remind you, Mr. Rendy, that 57 of our colleagues on the other side of the building were not opposed to this legislation. Mr. Schlapp?
Thank you, Chair Walker. Members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. The association does not support the passage of House Bill 3436. We believe, and I think you heard testimony this morning already, that the population coordination is one of the primary cornerstones of the Oregon Land Use Planning Program. It is fundamental to all the other work that is done, and the coordination with the county and the cities within the county is what provides the framework for all the other land use planning activities that has taken place. And if we do not have coordination, we will not have coordinated land use planning, and this will be highly detrimental, in our opinion, to the program that we've undertaken since the early 1970s in the Senate Bill 100. Let me just, if you will, indulge me for a second, Chair Walker. Let me just read to you 195.025, speaking to regional coordination of planning activities. In addition to the responsibility stated in ORS 197.175, each county, through its governing body, shall be responsible for coordinating all planning activities affecting land use within the county, including planning activities of the county, the cities, special districts, state agencies, to ensure integrated comprehensive plans for the entire county. And I would submit to you that those integrated comprehensive plans, the mosaic of the 36 counties and the cities, is what gets you the comprehensive plan for the state of Oregon. The counties have taken this in contrary to what you've heard, the counties have taken their responsibility serious with the adoption of the initial comprehensive plans and a number of updates of those comprehensive plans over the years. In fact, Deschutes County has accomplished coordinated population activities with their cities twice in the last 20 years, and they just completed it, and that is what has helped Redmond in their activity. It took 18 months and approximately $50,000 to do that. And it wasn't just an easy program when you look at coordinating the efforts of a number of cities and also the county and undertaking that. I would submit to you that this is really a change, a major change in policy, and one that the Big Look should look at, or, and I phrase it kind of funny, but it's really a question for the Big Look. And they should look at the coordination not only for the cities and the counties, but also state agencies. And if there is a change in that that should be forthcoming, it should emanate from the recommendations that they will be making to you in 2009. And we support the work that they're doing and are participating in that. You've heard a lot about LCDC rules, and I was a member, have been a member of the Goal 14 work group more years and more times than I'd probably like to mention. I was part of the process this last that just was finished with the adoption of the rules. There was a lot of concern, and we think that even though we thought we did a good job, it appears that further clarification in those rules is necessary. They're untested. We don't know whether they're going to work. And to put a rule language in statute, and I've seen it happen before, that it requires us to come back to the legislature and ask them to amend those. So we would have concern. We believe it's premature to put the rule language in statute until it's been tested and until we understand exactly what it does. You've heard a lot about counties not undertaking this responsibility, and I would disagree with that. Sure, counties can do a better job, and you have, more urban counties where this is maybe a bigger issue, and you have highly rural counties where they'd be so happy if they had an increase in population, you couldn't believe it at this point, especially in eastern and maybe in some southern Oregon at this point. But most of that work was done through periodic review. And through the actions of some of my associates, and with the blessing of the legislature, we have taken counties, except in a couple of instances, out of periodic review, tried to relieve them that responsibility. You've also heard about grants. I chair, Madam Chairman, I chair the Grants Committee for LCDC, and I have been a member of that since its inception. The priorities for LCDC grants has not been directed towards population coordination. This has been something that's kind of been on the back burner for the years. And counties have been out of periodic review, so the opportunities for grants has been minimal at this point, especially the last few years. Unless you're an urban county and dealing with urbanization kinds of issues that you see in Clackamas County, Washington County, and the like at this point. Since we've had the discussion during the administrative rule process, Linda Ludwick and I both have talked about renewing an effort to deal with population coordination, and the Grants Committee will forward to LCDC in June a recommendation that the coordination of population be one of four priorities for grants. We need to make this a priority at this point based on the testimony you've heard rather than something that, as I indicated earlier, is put on the back burner at this point. And we need to see that the cities and the counties come forward and make these recommendations. It's also been asserted that there's no way for a county to put pressure on the county to undertake these coordinated population. And I'm not aware, Chair Walker, that any city has approached LCDC and has asked them to put a county into periodic review in order to undertake this work, or has asked LCDC to put its pressure on a county to do this. I'm not aware that they've done that at all, ever. And I asked Mr. Rindy that question earlier. So I think there, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think there are a number of things that are in motion to address this issue in a cooperative manner between the cities and the counties and availing themselves of grant monies to undertake this work. And I would submit to you that this is really a response to a response looking for an issue to address at this point. I don't believe that this is, and I think that, again, changing a major policy in one of the cornerstones of the planning program should not be done in this manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schlack. Let me ask you this question. Did you make these concerns of yours known to the House committee or members of the House before they voted?
Madam Chair, I did testify at the initial hearing. I also sent Linda Ludwig an email outlining concerns with respect to this proposal. Unfortunately, I was out of the state when they had their work session.
Okay, but you did testify in committee.
Yes, I did testify as I am right now before
okay.
your committee.
And that committee vote was unanimous to pass the bill. Let me ask you this other question, if I might. In that survey that was conducted that Ms. Ludwig talked about, she indicated that more than half of the 36 counties in the state had either never adopted a coordinated population forecast or the forecast was more than 10 years old. Can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, I cannot at this point because I believe some statistics were brought to the committee, the Goal 14 committee, but I have not verified that, nor do I know who actually conducted that. We do know that at one point in time, all counties had coordinated population, but that, needless to say, is some time ago because we have acknowledged comprehensive plans for all counties and cities within the state. Now, how often they've been updated, I would submit to you that probably if I go to Wall County, they haven't done this work in 20 years. But I, as I indicated just a moment ago, Deschutes County has done it, you know, twice within the last 15 years.
Do I know who he is?
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Ms. Ludwig, I need to speak to you again if you could come forward. Thank you. Mr. Rindy had sent me an email. They tried to get in to see me, and I was booked. And he sent me an email. I read through it all last night, and he said the amendments were attached, and they were not. So this is the first time I've had to see them today. Have you seen these proposed conceptual amendments before today?
The Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Yes, Madam Chair, I have. And what the amendments do is they more or less got messed up the bill, but they, instead of putting the rule language into statute, they reference the rule language, which, let me be very, very frank, I took Mr. Rindy to legislative council to ensure that the department was fine with content of the bill. We talked with legislative council about this quite some time ago with Harrison Conley, and the two of them decided it was not the correct way to go about writing this. I know Mr. Rindy has since backtracked on this in the last week or so, and my response to him was clearly I didn't have any issue with the content. The timing was impeccably bad. Given the vote in the House, and that I didn't feel that I could offer the amendments to the Senate and ask the House to re-vote on these. Essentially, this bill does one thing. It changes and adds a time certain to the rule. That's all it does.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we reference the rules or put them in statute, at the get-go, my only concern was that time certain. Again, my concern was the protocol in the building and the lateness of this suggestion.
Okay. And the I was just asking Ms. Richardson when this bill was heard, the public hearing on it was April 3rd, and the work session was April 24th. So there's been plenty of time to work through this issue. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ludwig. I appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3436A, the work session.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3436A engrossed to the Senate floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3436A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion, gentlemen? I think we had some pretty clear direction today, and there are some problems that this bill addresses. And if it makes it off the Senate floor, then they can take their concerns to the center office if they don't like this bill. But I think we're moving it. So would you please take the roll?
Senator
Metzger? Would you step outside and see if he's out there?
Sure.
Thank you.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Senator
Westman? Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Aye. Let's hang on and see if Senator Metzger's just stepped outside.
Do you want to vote on that?
Yeah.
Okay. Get phone in here.
Okay. Senator Metzger, how do you vote?
No.
He votes no. Okay. Thank you. The bill's approved. It's going to the Senate, and I'll carry it. Okay. Thank you. We will move to work sessions. We have to hurry up here. We're going to open work session on House Bill 3104.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that we heard last week. It provides that the governing body of a city with a population of more than 400,000 is the budget committee of an urban renewal agency. You have unofficial ballot results before you that indicate that 52.99% of those voting indicated yes in the local vote on this bill, 47.01% voted no.
And I did go on the web. That was a 24% voter turnout. I think that was lower than Eugene, Lane County, but Lane County had a very contentious issue, though I think these were a couple of contentious issues. So, Mr. Landauer?
That vote didn't tell us a lot then, did it?
Yeah. I need you to come up. Are you the only one from Portland, the city of Portland, here today? Okay.
On this bill.
Yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to, I got an email from a couple of folks, Wade Fickler from the City Club of Portland, and also someone else from City Club. Linda Nettikoven, I hope I spelled that, pronounced that correctly. They were concerned that even though the ballot measure passed, that this bill requires the City Council to be the PDC's budget committee instead of allowing it to be permissive. So I did call Commissioner Sten yesterday in response. He's out of state right now, and he was not opposed to it being permissive if you wanted it to be that way, but I'm going to leave it up to you. Tell me what your city wants us to do, because we're prepared to move this bill.
Madam Chair, Mark Landauer from the City of Portland, for the record. The charter amendment that was approved yesterday is very clear in the language in making the City Council the budget committee for the City of Portland, for the Portland Development Commission. The language that you have before you has been agreed to by the five members of the City Council. I don't see why there is need for any change to the bill at this time.
Okay. I'm looking right here at the language of the bill. In summary of the ballot measurement, it says the council will be the budget committee for the commission. So, I mean, that's pretty plain on its face. And I think when folks voted for that, they understood that. So I'm not quite sure why we'd need to make this permissive. Senator Metzger, you're from the Portland area. What do you think?
I only have two streets in the city of Portland.
Okay.
More than
any of the rest of them.
That's exactly
and they,
right.
They don't fix the roads, as I hear all the time when I do go visit my constituents there, that no one seems to care about Lentz. But That's the only part of Portland that I have. It's just a couple little streets there, and okay. They're wonderful people, and I don't know how they voted on this, but I'm happy to move forward and to replicate what has already been done.
Okay, yeah, I just, you know, I understand the email. I understand the concern. They think that this would tie the hands of Portland City Council, but you know what? The voters said that they want Portland City Council to be the oversight, and quite frankly, given the information that I've received over the years about the PDC, I do think they could use a little oversight, and I did provide the committee with the story written by Nigel Jaquess, a Pulitzer Prize winning author, the story called Raw Deal. The city is paying millions to get out of the porn business, and I thought that was pretty shocking. So I think we're prepared.
In Roseburg, we just did it. Didn't cost a thing.
All right. Well, I just wanted folks to know we did get their emails. We did address them, and we're in work session. So have I got a motion somewhere?
Okay, Madam Chair.
This is impassioned.
I move House Bill 3104 to the Senate for the passed recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3104 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that my comfort level was going to be based on the vote, and the vote really didn't tell me much.
Well,
so I'm voting for it.
Oh, Representative Cannon.
Today, just to help.
Okay, well, Senator Cruz, as you know, a vote just takes 50 plus one.
I understand that, but and 50 plus one of when you only have 25 out of 100% voting is... I understand. Madam Chair, I was hoping for...
Vote is a vote.
I was hoping that the people of the city of Portland would give us what we like to call a mandate on this, and this wasn't quite there.
Well, it's good enough for government work.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
You know, you always make me carry bills when I give courtesy no's.
Uh-huh.
Cruz just kind of gave a courtesy whine. Assuming we pass this bill, I think Jeff should carry it.
Well, don't force me to vote no.
then you really would carry it.
I was trying to think of which Portland legislator we could get to carry this bill on the floor.
But does Senator Brown carry very many bills?
I think
that might be a suggestion.
I
would.
I like that.
I think she'll probably...
Because we haven't passed the bill yet, so we might...
Yeah, I understand that, but Senator Metzger, you assigned me a bill to carry out of your committee, and I didn't even serve on your committee, and I wasn't even on the bill, so...
There was a reason for that.
Madam Chair, I'm voting no unless Metzger carries this bill.
No, I think we're going to give this to Senator Metzger.
Two-street Metzger gets it, huh?
Protect your two streets.
Yeah, okay, so now that we're in work session and we've stuck our foots in our mouths, let's take the roll.
I guess I'm aye.
Weak.
Aye.
Aye.
A weaker aye.
Oh, come on. I can't believe you guys. All right, I'm an aye, and Senator Metzger, you're carrying it, unless you can convince Senator Brown to do so. Let's close the work session.
Madam Chair.
I think that was a good bill. Yes.
Before you go into the next work session, just so I don't forget, I move the rules be suspended to allow Senator Westland to vote on HJM3.
Oh, sure. Senator Cruz moves that we suspend the rules to allow Senator Westland to vote on HJM3A. Does anyone object? Hearing none. Senator Westland, how do you vote?
Westland votes aye.
All right, thank you. Okay, let's move right along. So I have a meeting with the Senate President in 7 minutes. House Bill 3178, open a work session.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3178A requires public bodies to make available to the public lists of vacant and unused buildings and portions of buildings that may be suitable for operation of a public charter school, directs that the list be provided to developing or operating public charter schools within 30 days of a written request, requires public bodies to enter into good faith negotiations with public charter schools or charter governing body with an approved charter proposal for lease, use, or purchase of space. You have a -A4 amendment in front of you that removes the good faith negotiation requirement.
be nice.
Okay. So Mr. Green is here to address the dash A4. Colleagues, as you know, I carried this bill over because there was a letter in our file, but no one here to testify. And so I think that's what this addresses.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I drew the short straw to testify on the Dash A4 amendment. What the Dash A4 amendment does is it would delete from the A and Gross version the good faith requirement. And you had a conversation at your committee earlier this week on the issue of good faith.
We did.
Legally, there's not a definition of good faith. When you take a look at good faith for a legal definition, what you really end up with is the opposite of arbitrary and capricious. Several of my school districts have concerns about what the bill would require them to do entering into good faith negotiations on that, because if they have a building, and this just occurred in the Medford School District just 2 weeks ago, where they had approved a charter school and the charter school said, give us your unused building. And the district said, we can't give you the building. One, we're going to save it, use it to exchange with other folks. If you have the good faith language in here, the concern from Medford and Portland and other school districts would be we could get hauled into court because we didn't enter into good faith negotiations, or it could be appealed to the state superintendent of public instruction or under ORS 338 and drag these things out. In ORS Chapter 338, which is the charter school law, there's another language that deals with good faith, and it's that a school board must review a charter school application in good faith. But what you did as a legislature there was you set the criteria that a school board has to use when they're going to look at an application in good faith. What you failed to do, or what the bill has failed to do, is tell school boards what does good faith mean in negotiating a real estate contract or that, and that's the concern they have. They don't want to be hauled into court. They probably could win in court, but that's not the issue. You get hauled into court, you got to hire a lawyer, you got to spend money to defend yourself, even though the action may not be winnable. And that's the concern with school districts on the issue of good faith.
Well, that was my concern. I just think it opens up to a lot of interpretation about what good faith is, and I didn't really get a very good answer last
And if you take a look, like I said, at ORS Chapter 338, when an application for a charter school is put in, we put good faith in there, but then the legislature also said, school district, here's the criteria that you have to use in approving or denying, and that's not in this bill as it relates to good faith negotiations on the issue of buildings.
Okay, so if they prepare the study and provide that to the charter schools, then if charter schools feel they're not dealing with them in good faith, isn't there an ability under the charter school law to bring action already?
Madam Chair, what they could do under ORS Chapter 338 is with any decision as it relates to charter schools, the state superintendent of public instruction or the state board step in at that point.
Okay. So they do have remedy.
They would.
Okay, so this just says you've got to prepare the list and provide it.
And it's not just school districts. I want to make sure that you understand that this is a broader list of folks than what was currently in statute. This requires any public body in the state to provide the list. City, county, special district, school district, ESD, anybody.
Yeah, that's right. It's
fire district or whatever.
Yes.
You know,
and other
school.
Public bodies right here in the bill.
Treasurer's office.
And
defined
I think that's
in
one
ORS 174.109.
A broader look at what other public buildings may be.
Well, I'm not opening that up to lawsuits if they don't all participate in good faith. This is pretty broad. What do you think?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash A4 amendment
Thank
to House
you.
Bill 3178.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash A4 amendment to House Bill 3178.
We'll see that.
Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, those are adopted.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3178 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3178A as amended to the floor of the Senate with due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing none, please take the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Wesley?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Cruz? Aye.
Chair Walker?
Aye. Bill's approved. Just going to the floor. Can I have somebody offer to carry that, Senator Cruz?
Sure.
Thank you. Oh, that's two you've got today.
I'm on a roll.
Senator Morse will take it then. Okay.
Balance. We want balance.
All right. Let's Open a public hearing on House Bill 3538. Actually, that would be a work session, no public hearing. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3538 permits the creation of heritage districts. When we last heard this bill, we were awaiting a conflict amendment, which we have today in the dash ones. However, the dash twos have the conflict resolution as well as deletion of the sentence the Department of Revenue had concern about. That succinct enough?
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, the Department of Revenue did have a question. Yes,
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 3538.
Okay, I've got a dash one. Where's my dash two?
It should be in,
yep,
it was just distributed this morning.
So the dash one is gone. Okay, Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 3538. Any discussion? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3538 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3538 to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Okay.
Yeah, he's getting this.
I have to give a courtesy no.
Take the roll, please. No.
Aye.
Aye.
Senator West.
Aye.
Vice Chair,
please. Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3538 is on its way to the Senate, and Senator Westland, you're carrying it. Thank you very much. I think we all got a bill to carry today.
It's so much fun.
Yeah, it does. Okay, any announcements do I need to make, Ms. Richardson?
Nothing.
You're the boss.
Chair.
Okay, colleagues, thank you. We're adjourned.